The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us. The number one listened to program in the United States for independent-minded individuals. Today, we're going to begin our program not with the latest on health and nutrition, which we normally do, and then shifting over to the environment, and then to important issues. We're going to start with our main topic. My guest will be on at the beginning of the program, talking about the shadow market, the different kinds of financial power among the wealthy, the global elite that manipulates the economies of the world. Now, reports came out on Thursday and Friday about who are the newest, wealthiest people in the United States and how much their wealth has increased as compared to those who are further down, the middle class, the working middle class, the upper middle class. Enormous discrepancies. How does this happen? We're going to explore that. Then later in the program, I will give you the latest on health and healing. Plus, I will also talk about the UN has warned of a major new food crisis at an emergency meeting in Rome. And what was interesting is that they talked about how many millions, hundreds of millions of people are in food crisis now, how there has been 30 countries with food riots in the last year affecting more than 150 million people. And when they talked about the causes, they mentioned environmental disasters, but that was second to speculative investors, meaning people who intentionally create a volatility with food commodities in the markets in order to profit from it. Well, if we are a caring group of people, and I believe we are, why do we allow this commodification? Why can't we simply say, for the interests of those who cannot defend themselves financially and politically, why can't we just have a few areas where it's just unacceptable to make money off of it? Is there anything we're not willing to exploit? And I'm going to have that as an open discussion, and I'll ask your input. You've heard of peak oil? Yes. And by all accounts, we are now at peak oil or beyond it. What about peak water? From William Bowles from Global Research, we'll talk about water. Water is much more crucial to life than oil will ever be, and it's being consumed in vast quantities by the same economic system that chows oil. Okay, in fact, water is a far more potent and relevant symbol of the way that we live our lives on this planet. I'm going to talk about water. Also, making sense out of poverty numbers, and then a commentary from Alan Grayson on Caligula's horse. And meet the new generation hot. No, not sexy hot. Environmental hot. There's an entire generation being born now that will never know a time where there will not be incredible environmental swings. Excessively hot summers, excessively cold and snowy winters, excessive rain in the spring and fall. And I'll talk about that from our environmental section. So that's our program today. Let's now go to our guest who is standing by. He is Eric Weiner. He has covered business and economic issues for 15 years as a writer and editor. He is a former columnist and reporter for the Dow Jones Newswires, and he's written for the Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, and Village Voice, and countless other publications. He's also a contributor to the Huffington Post, and his most recent book is a real eye-opener. It's called The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. Nice to have you back with us today.
Great to be here, Gary.
Now, not everyone heard the program last Tuesday, and therefore it's apropos to briefly define what is the shadow market that is resulting in the pouring out of vast amounts of money from the United States into foreign hands, and then how are these main players, and how is the shadow market a different use of financial power than we usually associate with Wall Street and their closest allies?
Sure. The shadow market really isn't like a market the way that we typically consider it, where there's a physical address like Wall Street or a building like the New York Stock Exchange or an index like, you know, the S&P 500. It's more of an invisible nexus where money is transferred into geopolitical power. And it's always existed. The difference is that we used to control it. We in the U.S. specifically, and we in the West more generally. So basically, it's like the providing of what Wall Street and the economists call liquidity. And the people who provide this money and have the willingness to spread it around naturally gain geopolitical power. And we've shifted into a new kind of world. And you were just talking about water and land resources and whatnot, and this all plays into actually what the shadow market is doing. We've moved into an era where the organizations, we'll say, that are providing most of the capital around the world for, be it development, be it for business, for our own lives, you know, financing the American way of life, are largely authoritarian countries from around the world. You can include China, obviously, but there's also the nations of the Persian Gulf, and a bunch of oil states. And then you also have Singapore in there, and you have Norway. But basically what you have is these large countries, not companies, that are providing this capital. And that is very different. And what's particularly different about it is that many of these countries are authoritarian, and yet they're using what we thought was a free market, quote-unquote, system to make money. They are using, or perverting, you could say, the capitalist free market system and using it in ways that collectivize their wealth within the government and give them enormous amounts of power. And they're spreading that power around the world in ways that are sort of hidden in plain sight or flat out hidden, because there isn't much disclosure, there isn't much regulation, there isn't much of anything that guides this.
Okay, I appreciate those opening insights. I'm going to just do a few moments of an overview, and then please take any part of what I'm going to say that you feel comfortable talking about, all right?
Sure.
I watched the movie Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps.
Oh, you did? Was it any good?
I liked it, but I probably liked it because I liked the acting. I thought Michael Douglas did an excellent job. But by today's standards, I think that the program was actually mild compared to what he did in the original Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept my interest. Now, I have a friend who is a vice president at Goldman Sachs, and he tells me, he said, and we've had many long conversations, and he said, look, Gary, a lot of people think that they know what goes on down here. Trust me, they don't. If they did, they'd be outraged. He said, it's all about the deal and how many people you can convince that the deal you're offering is the right deal for them to get into. You think these are the best and brightest and smart and analytical. He said, so much of what goes on down here on Wall Street is based upon pure hunches or want to be a part of an inner group. And there's not the kind of real in-depth scrutiny that you might assume. Now, mind you, this is a guy who's, in fact, he said that he said that when the crash occurred 2.5 years ago, he said that the man ahead of above him, which is one of the top 9 leaders of Goldman Sachs, came by his desk and said, "We're in tough times. Shoot the wounded," which Which was a metaphor. And he said,
I know what you're saying. But that actually is the way they speak. My previous book was an oral history of Wall Street. I know it well.
Everybody heard what he said. Mm-hmm. And he said, my God, there's a culture there that people don't understand. And so when you frequently see the more tempered and more reasoned and analytical faces on television, they're completely removed from what goes on down here behind the doors. Mm-hmm. So, the movie just brought up this whole idea of how people make the choices that can move massive amounts of money from point A to point B, and we're never aware of it. Because the average person is stuck into an economy where they go to work for 40 hours a week, they commute, they get a paycheck, they try to pay the bills and live within their means, and then their people come along, and this is the second part, and they become billionaires by working in hedge fund deals and equity deals and mega real estate deals, frequently with hedge funds. And this is where the new billionaire class is. In fact, only one person, Henry Ford Sr., made his money in the industrial way in the new billionaire class. All the other billionaires in the United States made it through making money off money. And he said, there's all these articles on Friday and Thursday and Friday showing who are the richest, how much money they made. And then finally, I was speaking with a friend who counsels foreign governments on economic strategy. And he said to me, we'd like to believe that because we borrow money from someone, that doesn't influence how we deal with them. He said, trust me. We don't deal with China on many levels and issues because of how much they pay our debts. And we don't dare touch Saudi Arabia and the abuses against women and forced marriages and beheadings and all the other violations of human rights because of $60 billion defense deals. He said, at the end of the day, profit wins out over and creates the politic, which then is managed into something palatable for people to consume. And he said, the people in those deals, the people who manage the money for these governments like China, you never know the truth of what their actual financial position is. It's only guessing. And he said that they're creating their own bubble, meaning China's got a real estate bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got manufacturing bubble, and they've undervalued their currency, so they have better trading positions. Could you deal with any of these, please?
I can deal with it all, actually. You did a very good job of addressing many of the topics that are in the book, not necessarily in the way that you laid it out, but it addressed. In the sense that when you start with what Wall Street has done, the issue on Wall Street, as far as I can see, is an inability to say no. And collectively. In 2007, before the crash, well before the crash, July of 2007, right when the Dow crossed 14,000, I wrote a piece for the LA Times called 14,000 Reasons to be Skeptical. I didn't think it was very controversial at the time. My point was that the Dow was, and our stock market had reached an untenable level of growth that wasn't based on any economic strength. And the reason I knew this was because I had been assigned to write a story for the Boston Globe magazine about the private equity industry up there. And these guys, one by one, as they were explaining their business and whatever else, one by one were telling me that they were just getting cash thrown at them from every angle. And this was 2007. And you could already see, they could individually see that they had more money than they could actually put to work, which is an odd position for them to be in, because usually when it comes to their business, they have to sort of struggle to raise capital and bring in partners and get loans and whatever else. And here they had banks just throwing money at them with no covenants, is the way they put it, which is basically no strings attached. So they basically had more money than they could handle, and I looked around, and you could see it in the mortgage market, you could see it in credit cards, that there was just this flood of money and nobody could explain where it was coming from. So I wrote this story, and I actually got creamed on like CNBC and wherever else, because it turned out it was very controversial because nobody wanted to hear the term bubble back in July of 2007. Fast forward to 2008, and it's now an article of faith of what happened. But when you look at where the money was coming from, that was my next question when I started looking at all this. Okay, so there was this flood of capital. Where is it coming from? It was very clear that it was coming from these foreign governments and, China and wherever else that were financing our debt. So they were quite aware of, this voracious appetite we had. And it didn't matter to them. They're not looking out for our interests. They're just looking out for their own, and they were willing to gobble up as much as they wanted to gobble up. And then when we started falling apart, it's a little known, little talked about episode, but the Bush administration actually sent around Treasury envoys, including Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time, to Saudi Arabia and to China and Singapore and all these rich countries, and ask them to invest in our economy. And they all told him no. And the reason was that they had gotten burnt on other deals. But that's the power of having the purse strings. So when you talk about, us talking to China right now, or us talking to Saudi Arabia when we're doing a $60 billion, the largest weapons deal ever for us, have you ever tried to talk to your mortgage banker about adjusting your terms when you need them to? It's a tough conversation, and it usually doesn't go well. And so, President Obama can get up in front of the UN and say whatever he wants, but China doesn't have to listen. We can hector the Saudis all we want, but they don't have to really pay attention, and they know it. So they do a little kabuki dance, and this is what's very different about the last time when we saw a lot of foreign capital coming into our country, like back in the 80s with Japan. Japan was like when Mitsubishi bought Rockefeller Center. Everybody went nuts because, oh my God, the Japanese are taking over the United States. But Mitsubishi was a private company that was distinct from the government. It might have been very closely tied to the government, but distinct from the government. Here you have the actual government doing the investing and the actual government owning the stuff. So, I mean, you're seeing abuses in Africa with China and the Middle East that make what's going on over here look like patty cake. I mean, they're basically just grabbing land and seizing water because as you accurately pointed out, land and agriculture is a water issue. And so they're grabbing as much arable land as they possibly can. Saudi Arabia just bought a farm the size of Connecticut in Indonesia, and they're going to produce food for the Saudis. And the Indonesians are thrilled because they need the capital, but none of the money is going to go to the starving Indonesians. It's going to go back to feed the Saudi royal family and its citizens. And this is going on all over the place.
Okay, I appreciate sharing those comments. Now let's go down to the average person. I realize I'm going to ask you to speculate, and mm-hmm. it's subjective, and it's just your own personal inner feelings, but I'm interested in them. Right now across the United States, there is still increasing angst about unemployment. Mm-hmm. Many people are angry about Wall Street and the American elite and how they could have all gotten bailed out, but not mainstream. And where the even the new poverty levels are not correct. I analyzed those carefully, and I saw the people that they had not included in their new poverty statistics.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean,
at the bottom level.
I mean, gee whiz, they don't include the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, who number anywhere from 3 to 5 million, mm-hmm. nor do they count most double-up families. And I'm doing a new film, a documentary on Poverty Inc., and everywhere I go, I'm talking with people. Oh, we no longer have the house or apartment. We're living in an in-law's mm-hmm. basement, or we fixed up the attic. And this is all over the place, and that's up over 11%. And then there are those young adults who normally would go from college to the workplace and apartments. They're going home by the millions. In fact, the census estimates 42% of all college graduates would be poor right now if they weren't at home. Now, do you realize how many, we're talking about almost 12 million would be listed, and they're not anywhere on any statistics because they're living at home. and most invisible are those whose incomes are above the poverty line but can't afford the bare necessities, a problem that is most acute in high-cost urban areas. And only senior citizens have been exempt from the general downturn slide. They're the only age group that experienced a decline in poverty and an actual increase in 2009. And workers, more than 3 million Americans, were kept out of poverty by unemployment insurance alone. They weren't included. But they're unemployed. They're getting an unemployment check. But they're not included in the unemployed and in the poor. And millions of other workers are struggling to survive job loss without government help and have little prospect of finding a job or current economy. And then there's 4.6 million Americans who are no longer even trying to find a job. And you got the new poverty also highlights the continuing plight of families with children, especially single-parent families, where there is rarely a second income to fall back on when one parent loses a job. And the most vulnerable families are those headed by single mothers, and among them the hardest hit are those headed by single women of color. And almost one out of five single mothers are poor, and that isn't for lacking or trying. Even now, two-thirds are employed. But in addition to the chronic problems of low wages and unstable and episodic employment, many single mothers have seen their work hours cut in the recession. So when you take all this into account, and then the government tells you, well, yes, we have poverty at the worst level since 1936. No, you lied. You weren't honest in the total numbers, or it would be a lot worse. So could you give us your analysis of where we're at? What is the likely outcome if we don't change policy? And what would you do if you, and I'm sure you've thought about this at some point, if you could have some power to make decisions, what decisions would you make? Again, I realize it's all subjective, but we appreciate your insight.
Oh, no, I'm prepared. It's pretty much accepted among economists that, broadly speaking, economies do well when what you're basically talking about is the wealth gap. And when that is narrowed, we do well. Our economy chugs along. If you look at the 50s and 60s, that was a highly productive time for America, and that was a time of very little or of a low distance between the wealthiest and the poorest. And there always are counting mistakes, but now or mistakes or counting irregularities, but now they get worse and worse because it's much easier to track the wealthy and much harder to spend the money to tracking down the poor. But if you look at where we are now, we're moving toward a new gilded age, and that's sort of the sign of a loss of an idea of what we want to really do with our economy. It concerns me when I hear that the wealthiest man in New York is now David Koch. The kinds of ideals that we want for our country to be successful, and that's for all of us, I think get kind of perverted when we're not looking at the idea that, like, you know, we should be trying to shrink the wealth gap. But if you think about it in terms of what's going on in the world right now, if we don't do anything about this, this is only going to become extended, because what you talked about earlier is the idea that the financial sector, which is a services sector, provides the bulk of the wealth in our country. So, you know, the most billionaires, all billionaires, are from this field. But China's number two in billionaires in the world, and many of their billionaires are industrial billionaires who got their factories funded by the government and whatever. But it's very different. They're doing productive things with their money. You can argue about the political system. You can argue about the environmental abuses. You can argue about the human rights abuses and the awful treatment of their people generally. But they have this rising upper middle class. They have 800,000 people with $1.5 million in assets, and that's growing. And this becomes a very powerful block if we don't deal with this. And the more they get, the and the more that we become dissociated from work and people being employed and putting our government, our economy to work, the more we sort of look out and we say, what the heck happened, and China keeps marching along. And what happens is we get distracted by issues, gay marriage or whatever, you name it, but our political system gets distracted by non-essential issues, and we don't keep our eye on the ball. So, I mean, in the book I talk about how the Pentagon held this economic war game exercise, and it was pretty cutting edge. They've never done it before, and the sort of a Dr. Strangelove situation. They had a bunch of economists and hedge fund traders and Wall Street guys in there, and they gave them different assignments. And it was set up by the Pentagon, and the CIA was there, a bunch of spies. And they're walking around in the room watching what's going on, and there would be some proctors in the front, and they would say, okay, North Korea, was melting down, what do you do? Or, Israel, Palestine is flaring up, what do you do? And basically what would happen is that America would lose over and over and over again. We'd lose to China specifically, but we'd lose. And the reason was that we never kept sight of what we wanted to do. We would always get wrapped up in, proving that we're this superpower. So physically, we would have fights with Russia in particular, but with others, and we could be goaded into doing a lot of empire building, if you will, or basically a lot of dropping of bombs and killing of people, rather than taking care of our economy at home and keeping a watch out for, rather than being smart and nimble, we would be aggressive and belligerent. And what happened was China would sort of go along making its own allies its own way, which is basically paying people off. And little by little, they would hold this hammer over us. So if I was looking at that result, I would say that we've got the whole thing backwards. That instead of, and Eisenhower talked about, I'm not saying anything revolutionary. Eisenhower talked about this. We should not be focusing so much of our economy and the basis of our growth on military. And we shouldn't be doing the things that we're doing militarily. We should be looking to spend that money on innovation. If our debt was there because, we were determined to build fuel cell technology, and this is why, we'd run up this debt, and our government was spending a fortune to basically, make sure that America and Detroit was going to build the electric car, then I think it would be a much more, palatable form of debt for everybody, because it would be going towards something that A, we need as a planet, and B, we could use as an economy. And instead, a fraction, a minute fraction goes into anything like that. Any sort of it, whether it's biotech or whatever else, goes into that. Instead, we fight over whether, you can use stem cells. And we, rather than, looking at solutions to big, broad problems, we like to fight. And we have a industry based on it. And that isn't good. I would want to flip that whole thing and make us sort of players in the world, make us citizens of the world, so that we could build alliances to check the shadow market, as I described it, to keep all this in line. And instead, we like to go it alone, we like to rattle our sabers, and we like to fight. And it's gotten us this far, I'll put it that way. And if we keep going the way we're going, it's not going to be pretty.
I appreciate these insights, and I look forward to another conversation with you, Eric.
Great talking to you, Gary.
Eric Weiner, the book is The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominates the World. Back in a moment with some commentaries and then your calls. I'll give our 800 number out in a moment. And a special welcome to all of the listeners in the Greater Washington Metroplex area and up in Baltimore and over in Virginia. 25 years every week on WPFW. Nice to be here. Caligula's Horse by Congressman Alan Grayson, one of those rare voices down in from Florida's 8th District. It's short, but I think relevant. Here's a short history lesson. The Roman Senate governed ancient Rome for 500 years. It looked much like our Congress today. The purpose of the Roman Senate was to rule in accordance with the wishes of the Roman people. The building in which the Roman Senate met, the Curia Julia, still stands in Rome today. In 27 BC, Augustus Caesar formally took control of Rome and established the Roman Empire. But the Roman emperors didn't abolish the Senate. Instead, the Roman Senate continued to meet for 500 years, doing pretty much nothing. Sound familiar? During the Roman Empire, the emperor held all the power. The Senate was simply a debating society, chosen by the emperor and serving at his pleasure. To prove this point, in 39 AD, Emperor Caligula appointed his horse to the Roman Senate. What we're heading for here in America is something very much like that. The way things are going, big money will choose our leaders in Congress, and they will serve at big money's pleasure. Big money doesn't put horses in Congress, just the hindquarters of horses. For the past few weeks, we've sent emails to our supporters showing how big money is trying to select, not elect, the Congress. And big money now has spent three times as much in lying television ads as all the money that the opposition, or meaning just the average American, puts into their efforts to see the right people elected. My opinion, I believe that we should vote out all Democrats and all Republicans, every single one, start from scratch, and completely reform the rules so that only the people support elections. My view is this, and this is not Alan Grayson, that's finished. I believe that if we had three-month elections, that's all, and no one could buy an election, no one could put their own money into election, no one could buy ads or campaigns. Instead, everyone could put up their positions and on all the important issues. We could read these, and then by lottery, we could vote for these people and then have open debates, so it wouldn't matter what a person's political background. Everybody who was selected would have a chance to share theirs, and then have a single term limit so nobody can collect power and then use it to their own advantage. Just a thought. Now, for two other things that are important, this is from the UN, and it says, the world may be on the brink of a major new food crisis caused by environmental disasters and rampant market speculators. The UN was warned today at an emergency meeting on food price inflation. And this has led to millions of people being food scarce. They simply don't have enough food. Now, here is my question for the people in this audience, and I'd like you to think about this and call in. We do not stop people from speculating in currencies, food, oil, water, and gas. And yet these are essential to our life today. And any group of people who has control over this can artificially cause the price to go up, as they did when oil went from $47 to $147 a barrel. It was later shown that all that came from speculators at Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, trading barrels back and forth. Think of all the people who suffered because they didn't have enough money to properly heat their homes in a cold winter, or how people had to curtail their driving. Think of the excess pain it caused. Never once were these people called out and condemned or criticized. So the so-called reform bill didn't require any stopping or regulating or any control over derivatives, credit default swaps, or trading commodity central life. And I'm thinking, if we as a people could see all the individuals each day who starve to death in the world, wouldn't we care enough to say, no, you can't make money trading in commodities like food? But we don't. Not a word. On the left or the right. What does this tell you? Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Also, your thoughts on this. The FBI and armed SWAT teams, operating much like the old corrupt, sinister COINTELPRO, are now targeting the left, and heavily armed groups are bursting into people's homes in Chicago and elsewhere. And what were these people's crimes? Nothing more than they were supporters of anti-war movements, and or they were involved in anti-pollution, like fracking from gas drilling. They were part of these movements. They were writing articles. They were organizing. So now the corporate polluters are protected, and the criminals get to get out of pass, a free pass from the federal government. But those who would support a pro-environment, pro-health for humans, now they are being raided. Grand juries are intimidating them. The FBI is engaged, as it always has, in these terror and cover-ups. And the mainstream media and the left has done nothing about it. I'll be interested to see if Keith Urban talks about it tonight. But I've been monitoring all the left media, and it's as if it doesn't matter anymore. We are a fascist state. We are absolutely a fascist state. And they also want to regulate the Internet, and they want the President of the United States, who backs this fascism. He supports it. What are your thoughts? Why won't the left stand up and denounce this? That now, if you stand up for anything that challenges corporate America, you can be put by any of these four private little corrupt organizations that all feed at the trough of the Defense Department or Homeland Security, all these corrupt agencies. You can then target any American who represents a challenge to corporate profits. One example, Monsanto has hired the killing organization Blackwater. You know, those loathsome little scum who killed those people in Iraq and got away with it. They are now going to go after, Blackwater's going to go after anybody who is anti-genetic engineering. In effect, they will be they'll be like Tony Soprano sending an enforcer out for someone who spoke out and shouldn't. What do you think of that? All in plain sight. It's reported, but not done, no analysis done. Because if you do something under the name of anti-terrorism, you can violate any right of any citizen in the United States without anything coming back at you. Your thoughts on that? And I'd like to hear what you have to say. Give us a call, 888-874-4000. 888-874-4000. I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment. I have one more thing here. Meet Generation Hot. This is from Mark Hertzgard and from Huffington Post. It's short here. It's just a paragraph. It says, my daughter, age 5, is a member. So is my goddaughter, Emily, age 22. So are the thousands of Pakistani children now suffering after record monsoon rains left 20% of their country, an area the size of Great Britain, underwater. In fact, every child on Earth born after June 23, 1988, belongs to what I call Generation Hot. This generation includes some 2 billion young people, 2 billion, all of whom have grown up under global warming and are fated to spend the rest of their lives confronted by its mounting impacts. For Generation Hot, the brutal summer that we just went through of 2010 is not an anomaly. It's the new normal. One wouldn't know it from most media coverage, but the world's leading climate scientists have concluded that last summer's rash of extreme weather, including record heat across much of Europe, especially Russia, and the United States, was driven in no small part by man-made global warming. Of course, no single event can ever be definitively attributed to global warming. Weather results from many factors, but according to the UN's World Meteorological Organization, the extraordinary heat, the rains, the drought, the flooding that occurred this summer fit the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's projections of, quote, more frequent and more intense extreme weather events due to global warming. In other words, dangerous climate change is no longer tomorrow's problem. It is here. But for most of us, the other scientific shoe has yet to drop. Aside from a fundamental few, most people around the world, in rich and poor countries alike, accept that climate change is real and has already begun to occur. Nevertheless, many non-specialists still do not grasp the most fiendish aspect of the climate problem. We can't turn it off. No matter how many solar panels, electric cars, and other green technologies we humans may embrace, the fact remains that more severe climate change is locked in for decades to come. The reason is the physical inertia of the climate system, the fact that carbon dioxide can remain in the atmosphere for centuries, even if global greenhouse gas emissions are magically halted overnight. Sheer physical inertia will keep average global temperatures rising for another 30 years, even if we did everything perfectly today. Not every future summer will be as punishing as this, but more and more will be. Members of Generation Hot, who live in New York City, for example, will endure roughly twice as many extremely hot days coming up as they do today. And growing enough food will also be a challenge. Corn, one of the world's key staple crops, does not reproduce at temperatures above 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And during the 20th century, the breadbasket states of Iowa experienced three straight days of 95 degree temperatures. Once per decade, now it's a big problem. And, of course, we know that Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all the Republicans, or most Republican commentators, Michael Savage, don't believe global warming is man-made. Most don't believe it exists because they'll use an example of a cold and very snowy week or month, not realizing that the hottest summers also are the same temperature phenomena that creates the coldest winters. And finally, on this topic of water, I want to get to this as well because this is the next problem. This is from Peter Boaz and Matthew Berger, and it says, meeting the growing demand for energy in the United States, even through sustainable means, could entail greater threats to the environment. The study was carried out by the Circle of Blue, a network of journalists and scientists dedicated to water sustainability, and could have implications not just for the relationship between energy demand and water scarcity in the United States, but elsewhere in the world as well. Quote, it is not just that energy production could not occur without vast amounts of water. It's also that it's occurring in the era of climate change, population growth, and steadily increasing demand for energy. The result is that the competition for water at every stage of mining, processing, production, shipping, and energy use is growing more fierce, more complex, and much more difficult to resolve. About half of the 400 billion gallons of water the U.S. withdraws every day goes into cooling thermoelectric power plants, and most of that is cooling coal-burning plants. That's according to U.S. Geological Survey. Meanwhile, climate change is leading to decreased snowmelts, rains, and freshwater supplies. One of the things missing from the discussion is the recognition that saving energy also saves water. So imagine then that our government, Democrats and Republicans alike, and our president in particular, have chosen to do nothing, I repeat, nothing, not a damn thing about the environment. You remember what I just said when it comes time to see your water rationed, and then water wars. And finally, from William Bowles, Global Research, peak oil, why not peak water? In fact, water is a far more potent and relevant symbol of the way we live on this planet. There are finite resources of water. It is also a renewable resource through a process of recycling, something that is done by nature in another of its amazing cycles that keep the biosphere stable. But we call homeostasis where life, chemistry, physics, and geology all meet, water is thus far more symbolic of the irrationality of our current system of producing all this oil, where even a renewable resource is consumed in this way. This is why I just can't get my head around the fact that some on the left are buying into this peak oil as the only thing and not looking at peak water. My view on this, I believe that in many places in the United States, New York, Los Angeles, and other places, you're simply going to have too little water in the very near future, like the next 3 to 5 years, to continue helping people live and energy for the cities and the manufacturing facility and the agricultural facilities that are there. We're just going to be running low on water in a lot of places, and we're doing absolutely nothing about it. Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Let's go over to Wyatt from North Virginia. Hi, Wyatt. Wyatt, you're on the line. Oh, they sent an email. And it says, want to know if we vote out Congress, who will replace them? No, I said don't vote for Democrats and Republicans. Vote for independents who come from a populist point of view, who are there not to serve a political ideology, but rather to reform, really reform, what our government represents. In other words, get normal people in place so that we can see real changes. For example, real people would not bail out Wall Street. Real people would stop the wars and stop funding the wars. Real people would stop all the major subsidies, socialization for corporate elite. Real people would look at establishing better teaching systems and have a single-payer insurance, and would help sponsor development in every community to re-energize the manufacturing base in America and get people back to work at the local level. That's what real people would do. Republicans, Democrats are not going to do that. So we have to. Comes a time when you simply have to realize that your vote is so powerful and so precious, don't waste it on people who are just going to continue doing the same things, because they're both the same. They're both from the party of elite. All right? So I answered that. If you'd like to call in, like to hear from you, we have about 8 minutes left in the program, and got an outstanding group of guests this week coming up on the show, and I listed over 500 guests we've had in the last year and a half who are all from the progressive and independent areas. Also, Jim Hightower, Danny Schachter, Matthew Rothschild, Mike Adams, John Rappaport, Norman Solomon, Robert Scheer, Michael Rupert, Jake Town, Mark Sommer, Michael and Justin Toms, Dr. Helen Collicott, Stephen Ledman. These are some of the progressive minds who host their own shows along with 85 others on the Progressive Radio Network. Now, let's see if we have any calls here, and we'll take a call if we do. Happy to hear you. Peter from Rockville. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Gary. I wanted to ask you your concern about global warming. How do you feel about some of these theories about getting the radiation back out to space? In other words, using reflective measures.
It's possible, but I'm much more pragmatic. That's an existential concept. I believe that we have to do things immediately, just simple things like going vegan to cut down on the amount of water, 60 gallons to grow a potato, 12,000 gallons to grow one meat of beef. Think of the difference in the water we would save. Think of going towards local food production and support. So don't buy something from a national brand that is shipped across country, increasing carbon footprint. That helps. Put a solar panel on your roof that acts on turning on solar fans in your attic that wick out the heat and that drop down the internal temperature of your house so that you don't have to turn on the air conditioner. Keep your air conditioner at 78. And with the combination of the two, your bills will drop in half. Get a solar hot water heater. because for a lot of people, their hot water tank is big issues with their wash and dryer and their showers and their cooking and their dishwasher. And stop using dishwashers. You know, do it the old-fashioned way by hand. And the things we can do, only buy what you know you're going to be eating. Stop buying all the national brands. Don't buy Nike. Don't buy Calvin Klein. Because they're frequently exploiting people in poor countries who can't form a union, who don't have any rights. So show that you're in solidarity. Boycott Walmart. Boycott Kmart. Stay away from the mega stores, because those were all built up by breaking the American worker, exporting their jobs, and then re-importing cheaply made products. And we can show that we don't need those products. We're not going to go there. If you watch the ball games, and I was watching some ball games yesterday, a lot of the ads were for the worst imaginable food ever. And so we have to be much more proactive. And I mean, really proactive when it comes to saying no to junk foods to ourselves and our kids. Those are the things we can do today. And that will make a difference. Remember, no matter what we do, we're still going to have increasing heat for the next 30 years. But still, we have to do what we can do to be responsible. All the best to you. Thank you for your call. Chris from Washington, D.C. Chris?
Gary, it's a great honor to talk to you. I've been listening to your show for years. My wife and I have talked about this issue of peak water long before it hit the headlines. And I remember a show on public television about the disappearance of the Anasazi. The scientists were saying, where did they go? What made their whole society just go up poof in a puff of smoke? They found out it was water had suddenly disappeared from, you know, they had some primitive water system that fueling their civilization. When it left, they just expired. They had to disappear completely from where they lived. And I see that as a foreshadowing for today, and I hope we can be more proactive about conserving. I'll take my answer off the air. I really think you're doing a great service, Gary. Thank you.
Yesterday, we looked at a place, some people down in Houston, which was 156-acre former retreat, and it was very inexpensive. The price had come down from $5 million to $4 to $3 to $2 to $1, and could have been bought, I guess, around $700,000. In any case, the one question I have is, does it have permanent water? And the answer was no. I said, then it's a no-go. Everywhere I'm looking, I'm seeing that people are stuck with having good ideas and building nice places and forgetting about the basics, the quality of the soil and the quality of the water. And I'm looking for a place to buy to create a sustainable homestead as a model to show what others in the world are going to need to do in the next couple of years. And if it doesn't have sustainable water from its own aquifer, then forget about it. I've seen beautiful mountains in America and beautiful pastures, Montana, Wyoming, the Monument Valley in Utah, and the Great Red Rock up in Sedona, and the great, beautiful big mountains with the pine forest up in Flagstaff. But if it doesn't have water, then when the water goes, everything you built goes with it. There are 16 states in America that will not be able to support themselves with the droughts we have, reduction of ice pack, reduction of snow, too quick of melting. The water goes too quickly off the mountain and floods. And we're seeing it every single week, flooding at astronomical levels where we haven't seen it before. And now it's just considered common, and it shouldn't. I'll be doing a lot more on sustainability, places to live, and how to be ahead of the curve on this. We have time. I'll show you. Thank you all very much. We're running out of time. Next up on the Progressive Radio Network, Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. And I want you to have a great day. I look forward to sharing more with you tomorrow at noon and 3. And any show you missed, and if you miss my noon show today, and you got to hear the commentary, you got to listen to it. Go to the Progressive Radio Network and look under the archive. It's posted now. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.